Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, July 22nd, 2013. I don't expect a jailbreak at Gitmo, but there is a break in the status quo in America's gulag. Jason Leopold has broken the story.
Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak somewhere in this town. See, me and the boys, we don't like it, so we're getting up and going down. Hiding low, looking right to left. If you see us coming, I think it's best to move away. Do you hear what I say from under my breath?
When the government wants to downplay news, they release it at 5 o'clock or later on a Friday. Extra points if it's in the summertime when people are on vacation and not really using their regular media habits. So it was late on Friday, and Jason Leopold stayed up late to write the story. I read it when I woke up on Saturday morning. But the U.S. government has notified attorneys representing Guantanamo prisoners, those who are in limbo, those who have been told they will never be freed and never be charged or tried. There are approximately 71 individuals who fit that description. And the attorneys who represent them have been notified that there will be a new process to evaluate their cases and determine if they should still be detained indefinitely. Now, for me, any news about changes at Guantanamo for the better is welcome news. But I'm scratching my head saying, why would you address that group of people first? And as you know, there are 86 individuals out of the total population of 166 today who have been cleared for release, some of them multiple times. They are still on hold. And to tell them, sit still, don't be hunger striking, we'll get around to you. But first, we're going to focus on the people who we've already declared will probably never leave Guantanamo, never be charged or tried or convicted. We've just decided that they're so bad that we're going to leave them in a legal non-state. And I say to Obama, it has been 2 months. 2 months tomorrow, May 23rd, is when he gave his speech, where he basically pleaded with the Congress to let him close Guantanamo eventually. He cited the hunger strikes. He engaged in a weird byplay with Medea Benjamin, as she brought to the attention of the media through her interruption, some called it heckling of the president. Now, this is a very serious issue that cannot be shunted aside. And it would be so easy for Obama to call up David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain, and say, I am going to honor your request and release the last British prisoner at Guantanamo, Shaker Ahmer. We've talked about Shaker many times with Andy Worthington, the worldwide expert on Guantanamo. And it would send such a signal to the world and to the other 165 at Guantanamo that things could change. I spent yesterday afternoon at a picnic with men who were life prisoners in the California prison system. Every last one of them was sentenced to what's called a life top. It was open-ended. They never knew if they would be released until the parole board finally opened the gates for them. And that dead-end status of not knowing if you'll ever get out is the hardest of hard time to do. And so to leave these men in suspended animation and say we are first going to focus on the people we have already permanently written off, I don't get it. And Obama presented a human side in that May 23rd speech. And I asked the human side of the president to have some compassion. Use the waiver system that is already in place and pop some guys out of Guantanamo pronto. It would make a huge difference. There's very little risk to the United States, particularly of the 86 people, as I say, who have been, in most cases, repeatedly, first under Bush, then under Obama, reviewed and cleared for release. And I'm not opposed to a new system to evaluate the 71 men who are, it's worse than dead men walking, they're just zombies walking. But is that the first priority? Well, we'll see how it plays out, but in any event, it is a positive development. More news in a moment, but you know, there are now several ways that you can support the Peter B. Collins Show, and I encourage you to do so. Did you hear about our new Kona coffee offer? Yeah, Russ, one of our longtime listeners on the Big Island in Hawaii, grows coffee. And he sent me a huge shipment the other day, and I am prepared to peel off 1 pound bags of this great Kona coffee and send them out to people who take out a new annual subscription for $50 a year. All you have to do is go to peterbcollins.com, look for my picture on the homepage, and right under it are the links to sign up for a subscription. And I really appreciate those of you who have gone to bat and provided the revenue that I need to keep this going. And the subscriptions are important, but not enough for me to make a living or pay all of my costs to bring you this podcast every day. So we have a new sponsorship arrangement with GoDaddy.com. And all you have to do is take your business there. You can sign up for web hosting, buy a domain name, and we will get an incentive payment, a revenue share from GoDaddy.com. And I'm very comfortable recommending them because I've bought domain names from them like PeterBCollins.com, and they have great web hosting and excellent customer service. I've been doing business with them for over 10 years. And right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, starting at just $1.99 a month, you'll get your domain name free. And today, I can throw in an extra 20% off their hosting 1, 2, and 3 plans. Just follow the link that is in the show file for this podcast. You have to go to peterbcollins.com and click on the link to this news and comment podcast. And then right there, you'll see it prominently, is the link to GoDaddy.com. The other news that they tried to bury late on Friday afternoon was announced by James Clapper, the top spook in our nation. And it is a victory for Ed Snowden. Why do I say that? Well, on Friday, the court order that was revealed by Ed Snowden, the FISA court order that told Verizon they had to cough up every one of their customers' phone records on a daily basis to the NSA, that agreement, the one that was exposed by Snowden, expired on Friday. Now, we raised this issue a couple of times last week. And frankly, I'm a little surprised that they publicly acknowledge that the FISA court has offered another ruling for another 90 days of dragnet surveillance collection of phone records by Verizon. And we can easily presume that all the other phone companies have similar orders in place. What is unprecedented is that they told us about it. And we've got to keep chipping away at the police state that has been built around us, at the surveillance state that monitors every move, every communication we make. Please, keep the pressure on. It is really the only way that we can achieve any significant changes. New York Times over the weekend ran an interesting story with a scoreboard on Obama's massive crackdown on leakers. And even I was surprised by the numbers on this scoreboard. Because I have repeatedly told you that Barack Obama has prosecuted / persecuted more whistleblowers than all of the presidents before him. But the numbers we've used have been beneath 10. We've been talking about Tom Drake. We've been talking about Kiriakou at the CIA. The other NSA whistleblowers, there are a total of 4. Bradley Manning, Ed Snowden, and a handful of others. But the Times reports that there are a total of 153 cases. And of those referred to the Justice Department, only the ones we know about have led to indictments. The other 150, well, let's subtract about 8 from 153. So, you know, somewhere around 145 cases have not yet led to indictments. But we now have a general who's being investigated for suspected leaking. That's General Cartwright. And it's just stunning to see that the Obama administration so far has won two felony convictions for unauthorized disclosure of national security secrets. And what this shows is that there isn't much basis. They cannot win convictions. They come up with a showy announcement of indictments and arrests and investigations, but they really don't have the goods on most of these whistleblowers to win a conviction in court. We saw that with Tom Drake. He ended up taking a plea deal where he pled guilty to, you know, some nominal charge of misusing a government computer. They had charged him under the Espionage Act and had no hope of winning a conviction on that basis. I'm pleased to see that the ACLU today has urged local law enforcement officials in Florida and Massachusetts to open investigations into how an FBI agent killed Ibrahim Tudashev at his Orlando apartment a few weeks back. In a letter to the Attorney General of Massachusetts and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, ACLU, in its typical understated manner, says the public has little faith in the FBI's ability to investigate itself. I have zero faith in the FBI's ability to investigate itself, and it should not be allowed to occur. We've seen that they've whitewashed every case where an FBI agent shot or shot and killed a suspect. They always say that the use of force is justified. And this case, which is an offshoot of the Boston bombing investigation, just is as stinky as they can be. We have the shifting accounts about how Tudashev, apparently enraged by being pressured to sign a confession for being a party to a murder case in Watertown, Massachusetts, and that he apparently went ballistic through a table, and then was it a knife? Was it a sword? Was it the light post from a lamp? Was it a broomstick? Well, they can't get the story straight. And this is the FBI that never has an unjustified shooting. And Tudashev was shot multiple times. He was unarmed. There were 6 or 7 shots fired by that FBI agent. It cries out for an independent investigation, and we've got this new guy being confirmed, James Comey, as head of the FBI, and to my knowledge, they haven't raised this issue with him at all in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And it is part and parcel to what we've been discussing, that we're all supposed to just sit down and shut up and accept whatever they're telling us. Because if you step out of line and you're skeptical about the storyline of Boston or Newtown or any of these other events, you're a crackpot. You're a tinfoil hat truther. But any rational and objective approach to these issues says, wait a minute. The government is not telling the truth. They may be flat out lying to us about what happened in this apartment in Orlando. And yet we're going to sit back and let the FBI investigate itself? Well, coming soon, a 2-class system for constitutional violations at airports in the United States. The TSA brushed back from its attempt to relax the rules about what you can carry on a plane a couple of months ago, is now expanding the program called PreCheck. And it allows you to pay a fee, get fingerprinted, have a background check, and for $85, you can zip through the airport without removing your shoes, your belt, Not sure if they inspect your laptop in that lane or not. And nominally speaking, sure, if you have a background check and fingerprints, is that as good as having them pat you down or run you through the Chertoff scanner at the airport? But this system can be gamed just like any other. You could fudge one of these IDs. You could fudge a background check. And do they actually check your fingerprint against your card or against your digital file when you go through? I don't know. But like these toll lanes in Southern California, the high-speed lane on the freeway is available to people who are willing to pay through the nose to use it. In certain portions of Orange County, for example, they have these toll roads and toll lanes. If traffic's all backed up, you go into that lane and you use your transponder and you pay quite a hefty fee. And so if you're rich, you're in a hurry, you don't care. But if you can barely afford the gas in your tank, and you're on your way to work in an hourly job, and you're stuck in traffic, it's just tough shit. And so these systems where you can buy your way out of inconveniences, out of scrutiny by the authorities, I don't feel comfortable with them. And if I travel a lot, I'd probably break down, pay the $85, because I hate the whole airport theater security ritual. Wanted to update you on a couple of issues related to the city of Oakland across the bay from me. I cover this on an infrequent basis, but I do like to keep you up to speed. The Oakland Police Department is a rogue agency. Over 10 years ago, there was a scandal called Riders. Cops were setting people up for crimes. Corrupt officers would not tattle on each other. And so the Oakland Police Department has been under the control of a federal court and Judge Felton Henderson. And I want to be fair that Oakland is a difficult community to begin with. There are people who are hooligans, rowdies, whatever you want to call them, provocateurs. And so it's a challenge to police Oakland. It's got a high murder rate, a very high overall crime rate, a high poverty rate. And they've had to cut the staffing of the police department because of budgets in recent years. So it's a perfect storm. But against that backdrop, we have a rogue police department that continues to blunder. And following the Occupy protests, there was police misconduct. There have been some cash settlements, a couple of $1 million paid out recently. They fired the police chief and installed a federal monitor. The new police chief reports to him. And now, against this backdrop, in this very weak foundation of a law enforcement operation in Oakland, they're proposing to spend a couple of $1 million of federal money to create what's called the Domain Awareness Center, a joint project between the city and the Port of Oakland. The project has ballooned into a surveillance program for the entire city. What they want to do is link surveillance cameras, license plate readers, gunshot detectors, Twitter feeds, alarm notifications, and other data into a unified situational awareness tool for law enforcement. They want to turn Oakland into one of those ant farms. You ever have one of those? You know, it's this little plastic community. You fill it with sand, you put ants in there, and you watch them. That's my image of what Oakland will be like. A city under total surveillance at all times. A city where there's a presumption that if you're on the street, you have bad intentions. And as we have covered in the important work by reporter Bo Hodai, when these surveillance centers that collect all available data, and this list didn't include Facebook, when they operate under the auspices of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force and Homeland Security's Fusion Centers? The idea is they share information so that all branches of law enforcement will be more effective. But sometimes the information they share is tainted, where they take free speech protesters and characterize them as anarchists and people who are likely to commit violence. That becomes a pretext for surveillance of those individuals. And it puts the First Amendment in jeopardy. And as we saw in Bo Hodai's reporting at Occupy Phoenix, the Phoenix Police Department and the Fusion Centers then shared information with corporate security departments. This is very similar to what we have in Lower Manhattan, where the security operations run by the corporate banks are almost fully merged with the NYPD. They have a joint control room in Lower Manhattan, where cops and security people from Chase and Goldman Sachs and the other banksters all sit together. And forgive me if I drop the F-bomb here, but this fits the classic dictionary definition of fascism: the collusion between government and corporate authorities. And when their missions become the same, we've lost control of our government. It's not serving the people, it's serving corporations. And Oakland is a difficult situation. There's just no question about it. I'm not trying to oversimplify it or just point a quick finger at the cops and say it's all their fault. There are bad people in Oakland who are shooting each other. When there were protests following the George Zimmerman verdict, 95% peaceful. But there were some activists in there, a guy with a hammer who was breaking windows and bashing people in the face with it. I don't know who he was. Could have been a police provocateur. I hope not. So I don't underestimate the challenges Oakland faces in any way. And last week, there was a shooting where a beautiful 8-year-old girl who had started a modeling career was on a play date at a friend's house and was an innocent victim of this shooting. And we have a case detailed in the Sunday San Francisco Chronicle about the whistleblower problem in the Oakland Police Department. And this goes back to the Ryder scandal of years ago. It showed up in the misdeeds, the law breaking by the police during the Occupy protests, where good cops refuse to report the bad cops. And the one in the article that I'm referring to here relates to a cop who watched his partner gratuitously beat up a suspect. He beat a handcuffed man in the back of a patrol car. And the officer who did his job and reported the wrongdoing of his colleague is the one who's paying the price for it. He's still on the payroll, but he is completely isolated and locked out of the department where he works. And this is just another example of the systemic, very deep problems in the Oakland Police Department. And I don't think we're going to see resolutions real soon. But spending $2 million on a total surveillance program for the people of Oakland, that's not on my list of ways to fix the problem. The other city in trouble right now, prominently, is Detroit. Paul Krugman has a great column in Monday's New York Times, headlined Detroit, the New Greece. And I'll put up a link to it so you can read it for yourself. But I think it's fascinating to see the way the Detroit bankruptcy is being spun. First of all, as I pointed out in our news and comment on Friday, the legal underpinnings of this move by the emergency manager of Detroit to take the city into bankruptcy is being challenged in state court. And a judge properly sized up that the reason the city wants to use bankruptcy is to get out of its obligations to pension holders. And my pal Norman Goldman, I was listening to him on the radio a little while ago, correctly pointed out that the pensioners of the city of Detroit, in over 90% of the cases, don't have Social Security. They had a choice of either the city pension system or Social Security. That's the way it works in most municipal and state governments. And so many of those people will simply be written off if they write down the amount of their pensions that will be paid. It applies to health care benefits of retirees and their dependents as well. And I don't know what the numbers are, but there are about 700,000 people left in Detroit. It peaked at 1.8 million 30 years ago. And some number, and let me just say, I'm just going to throw out the number 40%. Say that 40% of the people in Detroit have some connection to a public pension that is likely to be cut by this bankruptcy. How can that possibly be good for Detroit to further impoverish a large segment of its surviving population? And Friday night on the PBS NewsHour, Kevin Orr, the appointed emergency manager, and his boss, Governor Snyder, were there robotically repeating these PR phrases about Detroit. What a great city it once was and what a great city it will be. We just got to fix these little problems. Not one word was spoken about who is going to bear the brunt of this workout. And Snyder is saying he doesn't want any federal bailout money, doesn't want anything like that. I think it would make sense for the federal government to try to bail out Detroit, because for them to do it through the bankruptcy process, as I say, is just going to hurt a lot of people who are already extremely vulnerable, and it cannot improve the fortunes of the city of Detroit. Yes, there's been bad management. Yes, there's been corruption. Yes, the local government has been a failure. But to compound that by hurting more people who did not cause, I mean, the most direct cause you can make is some of them voted for corrupt mayors like Kwame Kilpatrick, corrupt council members like John Conyers' wife. And I'm sorry that John Conyers has a corrupt wife, but that's a fact. That's the only way you can pin responsibility on these innocent pension holders. But they're the ones who will be taken to the cleaners, and yes, unfortunately, Detroit is too much like the new Greece. And finally today, she came out of Detroit from the Lebanese community there. And I happen to have fallen in love with a woman of Lebanese ethnicity who came from Detroit. But the woman I'm talking about today passed away over the weekend at the age of 93. One of the most fearless reporters in my lifetime, Helen Thomas, who covered the White House for UPI until it was sold to the Moonies, then was a columnist for Hearst Newspapers. I had the pleasure of talking to Helen Thomas on several occasions. She didn't know who the hell I was. She didn't care. But she was a straight shooter. You ask her about Israel and Palestine, she wouldn't feed you the AIPAC line. She wouldn't feed you the Washington inside BS. She called it as she saw it. She was a tremendous role model for journalists and for women, both in and out of the journalism profession. And she stood up to George W. Bush in the White House press room like no other reporter during that dark, dark era. I'll always respect Helen Thomas. She gave a lot to this country, and I salute her on her passing. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment. I'm always interested in your comments in reply. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.